Hello and welcome to the Word with Webb podcast. I'm Eric and I'm here with the Reverend Dr. Richard Webb.
Hi there.
In this show, we get a chance to nerd out on a variety of biblical topics with Pastor Richard.
You're really going to like this one.
Before we do that, though, I want to thank you for tuning into this episode, and I would like to ask you a quick favor. Our mission here at Hope is to reach out to the world around us and share the everlasting love of Jesus Christ. So if you could take a second to rate and review the show and maybe send it to a friend, that's one thing you can do to help reach more people. Also, if you ever have any questions for Richard or topics you'd like to hear discussed on the show, you can submit those by clicking the link in the description. That's linktree.com/wordwithweb. And we've got two kind of events we've been teasing throughout this season, so I don't know if we need to spend a whole lot of time on it, but if you do want to hear more information on these, go back a couple episodes and we talk about it right at the beginning. But real quick, the Martin Luther pilgrimage through Germany that you're going to be taking people on April 28th through May 6th. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to say on that?
Well, I hope you like really good pretzels, great cheese, bratwurst. No, seriously, we are going to, I think we're going to have a really great time just experiencing Luther's journey in context. So mm-hmm. Come join us.
Yep. So that's a good thing to look out for. And also in the works is a potential live episode in early to mid 2025. So keep an eye out for that. We'll have more information in future episodes as well.
You bet. You know, you're going to hear, you know, clinking glasses behind it, you know, an audience. There's going to be laughing, crying, yeah. The whole bit, you know.
Yes, yes. So let's just get into today's topic. We're in our third week of Advent, and this one's on the Incarnation and Christmas. Mm-hmm. So first question, let's define the Incarnation. And why is this a Christmas topic?
All right, let's just start. What on earth does incarnation mean? It literally means enfleshment, something becoming a body, flesh. And so when we refer to it as a technical term, it's the mystery of Jesus being simultaneously and completely a human being and simultaneously and completely God himself. Mm-hmm. And then you asked, why is this a Christmas topic? It's because the incarnation starts with Christmas. You can begin to see how this is part of a larger story, so it's not like out of the blue. But it does begin with Jesus' birth. So if you were to look at both Matthew and Luke that have birth narratives, you discover that there's all kinds of themes that show up here that are basically a shorthand for how God's character has been playing out throughout the entire Old Testament. Hmm. One of them I would call the downward journey of God is God keeps chasing us down. And I don't mean he's, you know, hunting us down. I mean, he's always going to us. Jacob's ladder, God comes down the ladder. Mm-hmm. Abraham and Sarah, nobodies, and God comes down to some nobodies and promises them greatness. We're right before it. We're trying to climb up a ladder, well, a tower we're trying to build, and get greatness for ourselves. And so we get these reversals running all the way through. And these are reflected right back into Genesis 1 and 2. By the way, I heard recently that on a podcast, Tim Mackey kept apologizing for going back to Genesis 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But as he said, it all starts there.
Yep.
So we, in a lot of ways, it's not that God is coming down. It's just our perception's all upside down. Because to be made in God's image to rule and subdue the earth is to serve it, mm-hmm. watch over it and care for it, and then also to have each other's back because this is God's own character. Mm-hmm. And so God is simply being God and revealing himself amidst our attempts to be God, which are all upward, but God's way of being God is all downward. Mm. And you see this, and it's interesting, God's dwelling is on a hill, Eden. Then God shows up on Sinai, but what does God do after Sinai comes down into the tabernacle? Mm-hmm. And so we get these themes. So if you think of Luke, you've got all this power image going on. The angel, big power image, comes to Mary and says, you're pregnant, the Holy Spirit's done it. But then, you know, you get these little hints of the downward motion where then Mary hightails it off to her cousin Elizabeth. Why? Because probably there was so much scandal in Nazareth that she had to get out of Dodge. Or you have Elizabeth and Zechariah themselves. They're a childless couple, which means they're cursed. Mm-hmm. And yet God comes to cursed people and relieves the curse. You know, and with Mary, it's kind of like God comes to Mary and creates a scandal. Mm-hmm. So either way, it's messy. Mm-hmm. And then we get the next story is of Caesar exercising a power play by getting everybody to return to their home of their ancestors and register so he can tax the dickens out of them. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's a taker. He's going to take some money from everybody. Mm-hmm. And so he's moving everybody around the empire just, well, because Caesar can. Well, in the middle of this, you have this young couple who has probably got some level of scandal on them. And they head to Bethlehem. That's the city of David, where David came from. And because that's where they're going to register and then get taxed. And they get there in such a place that they can't even find a place to stay. So they're essentially homeless until they find a garage to spend the night in. And it's there that Jesus is born. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, winds up as a little baby who's pooping his diapers and crying and being utterly helpless. And, of course, because he's newborn, he can't see anything. So all the limitations of being a human being are on the limitless God all at once. Mm-hmm. So in Jesus, God is simultaneously limited and unlimited. Mm-hmm. Now, if that makes no sense, you're right. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. And again, Aristotle is overrated, but it's true. Mm-hmm. So we get this thing where finiteness and infinity coexist in the man Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then the throne, once again, it's a feed trough, you know, with dirty drool from the donkeys and whatnot on stinky straw. And so it's really unsanitary. It's amazing that he actually survived his birth night, you know. And then the next thing we know is a bunch of outsiders, outcasts. These are shepherds, and they're unclean because they're also butchers. And that prohibits them from entering the temple. We also know from Jeremias, who is a historian, that they're very dangerous people. You don't want to go near them if you're traveling. And the angels show up to them with an announcement that sounds like it came out of Imperial Rome, you know, that there's going to be a savior who's the Lord, mm-hmm. you know, and good news of great joy. This is all Rome's language. Mm-hmm. It's the language of power. And instead, it's all concentrated on this little bitty baby.
Yeah. So like when you're talking about this, first of all, you talked about the coming down and mm-hmm. coming down. How'd you phrase it? Not a power move. It's the mm-hmm. anti-power move. Mm-hmm. I'm almost like picturing. So I've got a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, mm-hmm. and recently I've noticed a lot like walking through crowds when I'm mm-hmm. holding my youngest hand, and he's trying to talk to me, mm-hmm. and I can't hear him because he's 3 feet tall, and I'm not tall, but I'm mm-hmm. you know 5'10", so the volume or the voice does not mm-hmm. get up to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm in crowds all the time, and I'm like having to kneel down just to yeah. hear him. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I'm just like, and mm-hmm. not to like paint that image as like a perfect mm-hmm. example, but the incarnation is both a coming down mm-hmm. and putting himself near us mm-hmm. to be able to relate to, or not, I don't want to say relate, but have a relationship with us uh-huh. in a closer way.
Yeah, yeah.
But also an anti-power move.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a reversal of what a typical power move mm-hmm. would be expected, because he deserves a power move in a different way uh-huh. we would expect, right? Mm-hmm. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, and let's go back to you and your son. Is this Rory, I'm guessing?
This is Rory, yeah.
Okay, you're a full-grown adult, and you have much more abilities than he does. Mm-hmm. But because you're a father, all your abilities as an adult are concentrated on serving him. Mm-hmm. And that includes disciplining him. Mm-hmm. You know, and so one of the things you do is when you bend down to hear him, it's not just an acoustic move. When you bend down and listen to him, he knows that he's seen. Mm. In other words, your heart for him is expressed that you're going to take the trouble to kneel in a crowd and pay attention to him. Mm. And so there's that downward move of God.
Yeah.
And in other words, you're expressing your fatherhood. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're using all your abilities, you know, in this case, your knees, your joints, and everything to get down there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then you translate whatever you've heard into action. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then Rory knows that his daddy cares for him. And we call this all, you know, when we use a more obvious word, love. Mm-hmm. So you're using all your power for love.
Gotcha.
You know, and that's why we talk about, you know, human beings as sinners are all into the love of power. Mm-hmm. But when we get it right and when we reflect God's character, it's all about the power of love.
Yeah. And that's interesting. I mean, I don't want it to come across like I'm the perfect dad in any way, because actually, in a lot of ways, that is just an acoustic move. But the way you're phrasing it makes it sound much more. I don't know.
Oh, come on, you like the kid.
Yeah. Okay, so it's an anti-power move. It's this. Mm-hmm. But why is this so significant? Mm-hmm. Why does God becoming human really matter? And how would like the ancient people have understood a God becoming human? Would that even have been something that they could really comprehend or even think about?
This is utterly fascinating. I just wrote some notes here. I want to make sure I get to them because there's a couple things. Throughout religion, there is a precedent of a God showing up to human beings. And for example, in Hindu religion, often a God will show up as an avatar. Now, we know that from like video games and social media, you have an avatar. Mm. Well, there's still a quantitative difference or qualitative difference between an avatar and the deity behind it. And then in Greek mythology, sometimes the gods will come down in human form, but that form is more like a mask. So there's no skin in the game to put it that way. Where in Jesus, Jesus is all of God. And this is a mystery of the Trinity, is the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, each one of them, they're not part of God. Each one of them is 100% of God. So 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. And so when you look at Jesus, you're looking at all of God. When you look at the Father, you're looking at all of God. When you're looking at the Spirit, you're looking at all of God. But they all exist simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And this is a great mystery because, again, it's illogical. Aristotle's overrated once again. And so God's got like total skin in the game, pardon the pun. Mm-hmm. In a way that the avatars of Hinduism or the forms or the masks of Greek and Roman mythology didn't. Mm. You see this. One of the most amazing things for me is when the woman with hemorrhages touches the garment of Jesus and is healed, and he asks, "Who touched me?" Mm-hmm. And there's some theologians that go, "Oh, well, he was just playing pretend because he's God. He knows everything." Mm-hmm. It's like, no, I take that seriously, that as a human being, he did everything the long way. And by doing that, he's demonstrating what a human looks like, mm-hmm. that everything he does, he says, we'll do greater works. I don't think it's all about the flash. I think he's saying this is what a human being looks like when a human being's fully in God's image. This is the stuff you are designed to do, people. Let me show you. Mm. It's funny because then the disciples mock him and say, "What do you mean, who touched me? How are you going to figure that out in this crowd?"
Yeah.
And then he goes and searches. Mm-hmm. And so once again, we see the God who searches you out. And so he searches out humanity, so to speak, by becoming one of us. Mm-hmm. You know, and once again, going back to the analogy of you, the perfect father, I'm going to embarrass the heck out of you on that one.
Yeah.
I'll behave.
Yeah.
Jesus then becomes a parable of God's character, but even more so because he is God and he is exhibiting God's character and he's consistent with the character God expressed in the Old Testament. In fact, the very fact that he's human is consistent. He will continue to chase us and chase us and chase us until we finally get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's this idea or this name in Isaiah, Emmanuel, mm-hmm. meaning God with us.
Yeah.
Is God becoming man, does that have anything to do with God? The name Emmanuel, God with us, because what I'm hearing mm-hmm. is it's almost the same thing if we're talking about the incarnation versus mm-hmm. the name Emmanuel, and God being with us.
Yeah.
What would you add to that, if anything?
God with us is a larger concept. And if you look all the way through, I love this. This was in the Bible Project. They were poking fun at certain Christians in the United States. And there's a saying among some Christian teachers and preachers that a holy God cannot be in the presence of sin. And we must be cleansed before we can stand before a holy God. And then they usually do something with Romans. And but that's often worked out that if you're a sinner, we don't want anything to do with you because you're going, we don't want you in our church. And that has very practical and nasty implications. Mm-hmm. So they rethought it and said, what does a holy God do with sinners? He pitches his tent right in their midst. I mean, again, you see this, Genesis 1, 2, and 3. You see this compassion of God who will not leave sinners alone. So the very last thing he does with Adam and Eve is he clothes them. And then when Cain kills Abel, the last thing he does is protect them. Mm-hmm. And that he's constantly pursuing humanity. When humanity is getting ready to self-destruct, he finds one family that isn't completely imploding and pops them on an ark, mm-hmm. And then he goes, he chooses Abraham and Sarah, messy, messy family, but he's intervening all the way through to keep them from, completely crashing. Mm-hmm. And then Joseph, who pretty well reaps the logical consequences of being a spoiled brat, he rescues Joseph from himself. Mm-hmm. Teaches Joseph a thing or two. Joseph begins to reflect God's character and wisdom and winds up running the Egyptian empire for Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. Why? To save his family from famine. So God's constantly working this thing. So God's not only a God who pursues and comes down. God is a rescuer. So his nearness is also an act of salvation, of rescue. And we continue this. You get into the wilderness. We have the symbol of Sinai where God speaks. He actually invites everybody up to Sinai so they can have a big Eden party, mm-hmm. And the people, sadly enough, are afraid, just like Adam and Eve after they rebelled, and so they refuse, mm-hmm. sounding like wash, rinse, repeat, right? Mm-hmm. God won't let it be the last word, so he comes down, and he dwells in a tabernacle. He even gave Moses the blueprints.
Yeah.
And then he wanders with them, and then if they don't get it, he's got the pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. Mm-hmm. And then he keeps moving forward. I mean, then when God brings them into the land, he's got prophets, kings, and priests that he inhabits in a special way so that they can be the presence of God for others in very unique ways. Then David builds a temple, so that's God's house. And there's always within the story of Israel a heaven and earth place.
Yeah.
And so it's no accident that in the Gospel of John, when he talks about Jesus, he doesn't have an incarnation, he doesn't have a birth story, but he has an incarnation story. And he says that he came among us and pitched his tent among us, mm-hmm. using the technical term for a tabernacle.
Yeah.
And that tabernacle turns out to be Jesus. So in Matthew, this is wild. Once again, we get the scandal.
Before we get into that part of it, uh-huh. it's sounding almost exact opposite of this idea that a holy God cannot be in the presence of sin.
No, it's completely the opposite.
The reality is that he chooses to be in the presence of sin, and that's this mm-hmm. maybe the significance of God being with us, mm-hmm. And even one step further, choosing to be. Mm-hmm. Choosing the incarnation as the method of doing that. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, spot on. And, one of my profs used to say God is in the business of doing business with sinners.
Hmm.
Let's take a look at Matthew. So the mm-hmm. whole, the birth narrative is much shorter in Matthew than Luke.
Okay.
But, you've got Mary, and then it says that she's pregnant. And then it says, and Joseph, being a decent human being, decides not to have her executed, but instead to divorce her quietly. Okay, that's very fast, but if you just slow that down. So there's a conversation with Mary and Joseph. Mary says, I'm pregnant and God's the daddy. I can imagine Joseph just exploding in rage and anguish, saying, you could have at least made up a lie I could have believed.
Mm.
I mean, are you serious? Do you respect me this little that you say something that stupid? Mm-hmm. You know, she's trying to say honest, it's true. And he stomps off, and his heart is so broken. He probably thinks, I'm going to get her back. But then he can't, excuse me, he can't bring himself to do what legally he has the right to do, which is execute her. Instead, he divorces her because he still loves her and his heart is broken, or he wants to. He doesn't actually. And then in the middle of all this pain that, you know, that Joseph believes that Mary has caused him, an angel shows up and says, no, God really is the daddy. But you can already see this thing starts in the middle of a mess. And okay, so Joseph now gets it, but nobody else got the angel. So let's say Joseph decides to go through with the marriage. Can you imagine the talk with mom and dad? Mm-hmm. Are you nuts? After what she did to you? And do you really believe that ridiculousness? You know, and maybe initially, not on our watch, you won't. And then finally they relent. I don't believe they get married until later. I mean, I think they're still just engaged on the trip. So it still may be family's refusing, mm-hmm. you know. And then he goes and takes, a woman he's not yet married to off to another place. I'd have to take a look at my chronology. But at any rate, the point is nobody's believing this, mm-hmm. So she's in scandal and Joseph is in scandal for not having the guts to, you know, what's he doing hanging on to her? Mm-hmm. So you've got all this going on. So these people are less than nobodies. These people are just, as far as everybody's concerned, they're human failures. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that she is going to have a kid who's going to be named Emmanuel, which means God with us. So God is with them already. Now, this is actually a quote from Isaiah where King Ahaz, Isaiah's come to Ahaz and says, ask the Lord anything and he'll do it. And Ahaz, by the way, Ahaz is not a God follower. He instituted child sacrifice, so you know the guy's a jerk. But Ahaz somehow says very piously, oh, I could never test the Lord my God. And you're like, oh, please. And so Isaiah goes, okay, Mr. Pious One, since you wouldn't even do that, the Lord will give you a sign that there will be somebody born named Emmanuel. And then it goes on and unpacks this person and says certain events will happen. And that's the way God is saying, I am the Lord of history, Ahaz, stop trying to be God. So Matthew, moved by the Spirit, quotes this, even though it's from a different original context. Mm-hmm. Is saying, if God can do that with some kid, you know, several hundred years before to demonstrate that his power and presence is still in history, regardless of what Ahaz thinks, what happens when this time it's literally God with us? So Matthew's upping the stakes. Mm. And again, this is more of a title because his actual name is Jesus, which is interesting. So what does the God who's with us do? Well, let's go to the title, Yeshua or Jesus. That means God is saving. So the God who is with us is the God who saves, which again, that's Old Testament. The God who is with us is the one who rescues our behind over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And this time it's going to be the final behind rescuing, mm-hmm. the great one. Let's get our brains out of 13-year-old jokes. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, you know, you've got the strange thing of a couple in scandal giving birth to God himself. And then here, instead of shepherds, we've got pagan astrologers who dabble in the occult. And then we've also, and they bow down, mm-hmm. you know, which is just insane. Mm-hmm. And so God is using all the wrong people to worship this little baby. Mm-hmm. So now we're seeing other themes. Remember, what does a holy God do in the presence of sinners? He calls them to himself. So we have the shepherds, we have the magi. And what's he going to do with Peter, James, and John? Call them to himself. You know, follow me. Mm-hmm. And then in Mark, it says he called his disciples, and I love this phrase, so that he might be with them. Not so he can teach them, so he can equip them to do what he wants them to do, but so they might be friends. Mm-hmm. Which takes us right back to Genesis 1 again. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it just is mind-blowing. You know, and we haven't even gotten to the mechanics of the incarnation. More, we've gotten to the heart of God behind it.
Right. Well, so let's just go back and kind of see, where does the incarnation start then? Like, is Christmas the first incarnation, or is this idea that we're talking about Genesis 1, like, was that plan A from the beginning, right? That, or were there other incarnation? I mean, we talked about Christophanies before, and the appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament, or and they're, you know, not really clear, but where is this first starting? And like, why is it necessary?
I would say the difference between the Christophanies in the Old Testament, and okay, we'll unpack that word for a second.
Yeah.
It means where Christ is revealed. Christ, the Messiah, or Christ. And ophany comes from epiphany, in other words, the revealing of Christ. There is strong suspicion that the angel of the Lord may be God the Son without flesh. Another term for that in Greek is logos asarkos, which means the word without flesh. I think the difference between those, where the angel of the Lord shows up, say, to Hagar or to Jacob, is while they appear to be a being that is simultaneously God and distinct from God, they don't appear to be human. I mean, they have human appearance. But what we don't have is the paradox of no limit and limit all at once, or finite and infinite all at once. So there seems to be a significant difference between the angel of the Lord and the incarnation.
Gotcha.
But I want to get what's behind that, the idea of God with us. That was the plan A, is that, you know, you have this garden inside this region called Eden, and then God creates humans in his image to be like him. And then he gives them the assignment to run the garden the way he runs the world. And we just talked about that. And so there, to be, the fancy word is co-regents, but it means basically to manage the garden together with God. So, and this is shocking, because in most other creation stories, humans are slaves to do what the God doesn't want to do. We're here, humans are partners to do exactly what God does. And so this is a very, very deep and intimate relationship. So God is definitely with them. And then the interesting thing is, this is immediately mirrored, because we have a human who God says, not good for the human to be alone, splits it in two. Now we have male and female, and then God says, y'all get together again. And so just how humans deal with each other in marriage and other relationships is echoing the relationship God wants to have with us. So already God is created this sort of with-usness between us and him, but also between each other as humans. We go and biff it when we rebel, and then God says, I will not let your rebellion be the last word. And then he gives a promise. He says there will be a strange warrior who will come and will crush the head of the serpent, even though the serpent will bite the warrior, which means the warrior will pay the price of his life because of the snake venom. And so there is this promise. God's going to undo this mess. And then he makes that promise again to Abraham and Sarah through a covenant, where he says, and this is really important, he says, I will keep this covenant no matter whom breaks it, even at the cost of my own life, which sounds absurd on the face of it. How's God going to get killed? You know, well, here's a vulnerable baby, so we now know where this goes. You know, so we begin to see, you know, the outlines of a story. And so the with us God then throughout the Old Testament becomes the pursuing God. And then the Christophanies, I do think, are echoes of the with us. In other words, they're visible reminders. I love Hagar refers to, names the place where she encountered the angel of the Lord as the place where of the God who sees me.
So could God have been with us without the incarnation then? Wasn't God with us, or with Israel, in the Old Testament through like the tabernacle and the temple, and like we've talked about? And so, like, help me understand, like, why the incarnation is necessary if there's this withness.
I think a couple things. One is, when we rebelled, evil got loose on the planet in a way that hadn't happened before. And it was in a way that humans could not undo it. And not only that, when God showed up, humans tended ultimately to push him aside. I think the saddest and most obvious example of this is he's on Sinai, and he is writing up the blueprint for his tent, his tabernacle, where he's going to dwell among his people. Again, remember, they refused to come up to the mountain, so he's going to go down. Mm-hmm. Well, while he's doing this, and in eyesight of Sinai, the people have decided to erect a golden calf, which is the manifestation of the fertility goddess Hathor from Egypt. So they're dragging Egypt back into their freedom. They're re-enslaving themselves. Mm-hmm. And just to make it sound nice and pretty, they rename it Yahweh. But they behave like it's Hathor, where they basically have a big honking orgy. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, it's one thing to get the people out of Egypt, but apparently it's another thing to get the Egypt out of the people. Mm. And so there seems to be this humanist insistence to remain in slavery. And so this is what happens when God just shows up as God is, you know, people might make nice for a little while, or sometimes there's just active resistance from the get-go. So then finally, you know, God is doing all sorts of things to keep the covenant together, and there's greater and greater rebellion. Then God exiles his people, and there's a little bit of repentance, but once some of them get back to rebuild the second temple, then you read Malachi, you know, he accuses them of being worse than before the exile. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, what's a God gonna do to clean up the mess that humans continually, you know, recreate over and over again, you know? And so finally God says, I made a promise, and I'm going to keep it even if it kills me. And so he becomes a human being in all the ways that a human being is human. And he does something very interesting, and this is where I think you can see a trajectory and even an intentionality where Jesus deliberately as an adult provokes a reaction by just being him. And he basically just is full-on display the character of God, chases after the nobodies, just like God has been doing all along in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. You know, he gives life to the people nobody thinks deserves life. You know, he goes after the unclean. He touches the unclean to make them unclean. And what happens? Israel's best and brightest and Rome's most powerful all collude together to kill him. So all of a sudden, when the world sees God fully on display, their reaction is to kill him off. And this is the ultimate treason. The best way to blow up a covenant is to kill the author of the covenant, wouldn't you think? Mm-hmm. Well, remember, God runs everything upside down or right side up. So unbeknownst, all the evil concentrated in the world at this point is thrown upon Jesus, and it plays right into his hands. Because God is the God who comes up under. God is the God who comes down, you know. And so he goes down with all this sin. In other words, apparently no one's going to fix this mess except God himself. Mm-hmm. Because humans have no interest in keeping the covenant. So God, and so when humans blow the covenant up as much as they can, this is fascinating. When he dies and rises from the dead, human history on human's terms ends. Mm-hmm. In other words, we threw the best we could at him to get him out of the picture, and it wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. And that's good news. Mm-hmm. But it starts with this little kid pooping his diapers. I mean, this is an intimate participation with humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to see what God, how much God cares for his creation, how he values them, where he places them hierarchically, because remember, we're little spots of humanity in a massively gigantic galaxy, one of billions of galaxies, you know, and our galaxy has billions of stars, so we're pretty insignificant. Mm-hmm. And yet this crazy, amazing God, he's not really crazy, makes a decision to treat us like equals and then to value us so much to give his life for us. And so the birth of Jesus is sort of like all that shorthanded. This is nuts. Why would God show up as a human baby you know, with all the messiness of birth, then in a garage, in a feed trough, in one of the nastiest times of human history, where his own people have fallen completely apart, are completely corrupted, and they're being stomped on by the Romans. Mm-hmm. And inside all that, he is the child of these two scared teenagers who are living in scandal. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about really just heaving it on. I mean, if anybody accuses God of, well, you know, you had it easy. No, he didn't.
So if someone were to ask, like, could it have been done a different way? Uh-huh. It sounds like what you're saying is the answer, I think it's obviously yes, but the fact that it was such an extreme coming down is what makes the incarnation and Christmas so... surprising is that it could have been done any other easier way. Does that make sense?
It does. If you're hearing noise, I just turned off my phone, so we should have relief now.
Just a little bit of buzzing. Yeah. Yeah. No, but that, like the what I'm hearing is like that it could have been done a different way. It could have been done a much easier way. But the fact that it was done this way in the incarnation is shocking. And an extreme version of what needed to be done.
Yeah, and you know, Jesus talks about it being necessary that the Son of Man would suffer and be crucified and on the third day rise. It's not necessary in the sense that God was not constrained by outside forces to do it this way. Mm-hmm. It's God's God. He can do what he pleases. Mm-hmm. But I would say that this is the God way. Mm. In other words, no other way would have been consistent with God's character. Mm-hmm. For example, he could have taken his magic wand and just made us all obedient. But remember, he wants friends, not puppets. Mm-hmm. Or he could have wiped us completely out and just hit the reset button. Mm-hmm. Did that once. Didn't work out so well. Mm-hmm. You know, so in that way, there's a necessity from God's own internal character. Mm. If God is going to be true to being God, this apparently is the way it's going to get done.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. This is the way I would put it. God constrains himself by his own character. Mm. And this is a deep mystery. But there's an analogy with human beings. The minute you make a choice, you exclude other choices. So when God made a choice for us, he excluded other choices. Mm-hmm. And this is crazy because God is unlimited. But because of his unlimited love, he chose to limit himself to consistency with his own character. And you see this because, again, the incarnation and the crucifixion are the logical conclusion to the promise, I'll hold this covenant together even if it kills me. So he comes down. He exposes himself. What's on full display may not be the unfiltered God, you know, which apparently would give everybody a heart attack, but the unfiltered character of God is on display. Mm-hmm. And the human reaction is murderous. Mm. You know, in other words, we want nothing, on our own, we want nothing to do with the kingdom of God or God because we want our own kingdom and to be God ourselves. Mm. And he ends that when we throw everything we can at him, and he beats it, you know, and again, it's way beyond our pay grade. I mean, when I'm preaching on it, I talk about then in a mysterious way we can't quite explain or comprehend, he takes all the sin of the world, heaps it gladly on his shoulders, throws it down into the place of the dead, and then comes up victorious and brings victory to us. Mm-hmm. But once again, the crucifixion makes most sense when it's viewed through the incarnation. In other words, the mystery of God becoming a human being and the pattern that all the wrong people worship him, the wrong people were selected to have him. He did it the wrong way, according to human logic. If you're going to be God Almighty born into humanity, you know, why surround yourself with scandal and poverty, you know, and powerlessness? Mm-hmm. because you are going to be the one who becomes powerless on the cross. So in that way, the incarnation is a foreshadowing of the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've heard you say what is assumed cannot be saved. Can you explain that?
Yeah. There were various debates about who Jesus actually was. And this is part of those debates. And I know you, this is like one of those things where we break the third wall or whatever it is, or the fourth wall.
Yeah.
So I am telling the listener that there is a question in here about who Jesus actually is and the debate around that. So what is assumed cannot be saved is part of that. Is it all right if I go ahead and just head in there?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a big debate that happens, especially as the church, the followers of Jesus, begin to be majority Gentile. So people are now thinking Jesus through the lens of Greek and Roman philosophy. And for many theologians and Christian philosophers, the way Jesus is described by the first disciples doesn't make sense to them. So they start rethinking it and getting it wrong in oh so many creative ways. So I'm just going to go through those for fun. One is Arianism, where Jesus is of similar substance to God, but not the same substance. Mm-hmm. Or another way to put it, a similar being to God, but not the same being. And a guy named Arius invented that. And that was voted down. Mm-hmm. Then there's Docetism, where Jesus only put on a mask, like the Greek and Roman gods. Mm-hmm. And for example, in I think it's the Gospel of Thomas, which is Docetic, the man Jesus is on the cross, and the Son of God leaves the man to die. Because, of course, the Son of God can't die because he's infinite. Mm. So that solves a problem, according to Greek and Roman logic. Mm-hmm. Once again, that got voted down. And then there's adoptionism, where Jesus was just an old, normal human person. And when he gets baptized, God adopts him. And so then he's pulled up into the Godhead. There's even softer goofiness. Sometimes people will overemphasize Jesus' humanity at the expense of his deity, or they'll overemphasize his deity. That's often a modern Christians will go on and on and on about how Jesus is God, and they get very, very uncomfortable with things like God on the cross. Mm. Martin Luther, one of the contributions he gave to the church is that he stood there and pointed to the cross and see who's on that? That's God there. And that often made the Reformed theologians a little bit uncomfortable. Mm. Some people think he's just a good teacher, you know, on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Other groups ignore his teaching and hyper-focus just on the passion, death, and resurrection. So all of that is all the ways we've gotten goofy. So where do we get this, you know, what is not assumed is not saved or has not been saved? That would be particularly Arianism. In other words, both Arianism and Docetism, because both of them kind of had lopsided Jesus. So Arianism, Jesus is not God. So if Jesus is not God in the sense of just maybe a divine being, mm-hmm. well, it requires God to pull the job off. And so Jesus turns out not to be up to the job. So and with Docetism, he's not completely human. And that's where what is not assumed cannot be saved. Docetism was voted down because Jesus rescued us because he was completely human. And in this case, humans owed the debt to God. So Jesus becomes a human so he can pay the debt, but he's God, so he's up to the job. Hmm. So that's where all that comes. Let me see if I can put that in modern language, because that's all kind of fourth century arguments that are a little bit foreign to us.
Yeah, and before we do that, my understanding of this the phrase "what cannot be assumed cannot be saved" is if he doesn't become human, then he can't save humans, right?
Exactly.
Okay, just making sure I'm on the right understanding that, right?
Yeah, no, you're spot on. So think of it this way: is God comes and becomes a full human and then goes on the journey with us. Mm-hmm. He's not walking above us now. He's walking right with us. Mm-hmm. And he takes on our sin. So in a curious way, he becomes chief of sinners. Mm-hmm. And so he's our proxy, or he's our stand-in. Mm-hmm. And as Paul said, he who knew no sin became sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. And so he literally becomes the stand-in for all of guilty humanity by being all of guilty humanity. Now, this is an incredible dialectic or paradox, because he never committed sin, but he freely takes on our sin. And so he dies a sinful human being, not by what he committed, but by what he took on. Mm-hmm. And he's God, so he's able to defeat it. And so this is the mystery. So if you get rid of the human side, then there's no one to take on our sin. If you get rid of the God side, then whoever it is not up to the job. Mm-hmm. And so he takes the journey of death for us. Mm-hmm. And so he robs death of its sting, as Paul says. Mm-hmm. And then death no longer gets the last word, because death did its worst to Jesus. And in other words, death took Jesus and Jesus took death.
Mm. But it's so... Did you say that saying, what is not assumed cannot be saved, is mm-hmm. an Arianism belief?
No, it was a counter to Arianism and Docetism.
Okay. I might have heard you wrong. I thought you were saying it was Arianism, and I was...
No.
Okay, I got that reversed.
So that's why Arianism and Docetism were voted down.
Because of that.
Yeah, and this was gotcha. The slogan that was used against Arianism and Docetism.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, so we kind of did a little bit of the birth narratives.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything in the birth narratives that you want to continue going over that maybe some people miss when it comes to the incarnation, or that you really want to highlight in this around this topic? Did we fully hit everything you were wanting to do on that?
Let me just check. There's some really cool stuff in Matthew, again, with the with us theme.
Mm-hmm.
So, and so we start out with God with us, and then he shows up. And then who's he with? Well, he's also with the Magi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now they come to him, but he guides them to him. So God literally reaches out with the star to a bunch of pagan occult astrologers who represent a pagan empire.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they got their king, but then they come in and worship the true king. And then, interesting, that Israel's own king, his response, just like Israel's own religious rulers, is to try to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting. So what happens is he winds up hightailing it to Egypt. And what is fascinating is this is a sad commentary. So he got up. This is Joseph. This is about the escape to Egypt. Joseph gets a dream. He gets up, and he takes the child and his mother during the night and leaves for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so it was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I have called my son. It's like, wait a second. No, they just went to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go, ooh, Matthew's not proof texting very well. No, Matthew's doing a commentary. What is the Egypt that he just fled?
Mm.
His own people. The king of the Jews, Herod, wants to kill the king of the Jews. And so all of a sudden, Jerusalem has become Egypt. Mm. And just like for Joseph's family, Egypt has now become the place of God.
Mm.
And so that's a signal that God intends one day to make Egypt Israel.
Mm.
And then, you know, he comes back. And then if we were to keep going, I'm going to go to the baptism, because you get this theme reinforced. So Jesus comes to be baptized, and, you know, we've all got all this John the Baptist language. I baptize you with water, but one comes after me is going to baptize with the Holy Spirit and fire. You can imagine John thinking of somebody, and then his cousin shows up, and he's going, huh? And then he comes to be baptized, and John says, wait, you're coming to me, but I'm the one who needs to be baptized by you. And Jesus says, let it be so now, for it is proper to fulfill all right-making. The word is righteousness, but I'm using it kind of in its root. So what happens? Jesus, with the people, walks through the Red Sea with them to freedom, because that's what baptism is, as a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reenacting of the crossing of the Red Sea out of Egypt into the Promised Land. So Jesus is being like Moses with the people. And so we begin to see that Jesus' whole journey is with them.
Mm.
And so this is such an important thing for Christmas. Christmas is a time, you know, it's the most wonderful time of the year
mm-hmm.
for some.
Mm-hmm.
for many, it's going to be a time where once again, the family's going to blow up because someone picks a fight with someone else. There's going to be time that someone you really care about is not at the table. Mm-hmm. If you're divorced, it's going to be all the times that are no more. Mm-hmm. All kinds of things. You may be on the streets. You may be suffering from addiction. You may be having financial hardship. For some reason, big companies like to lay everybody off about 2 days before Christmas. Bring a little cheer to the And so suddenly you're wondering, how am I going to provide? I just bought all these presents for my kids, and I did it on my credit card, and suddenly I don't have a salary. Mm-hmm. So it's not fun. And to me, one of the most important things that we can meditate on is this is not a celebration of softness and sweetness and everything perfect. This is a celebration of God showing up in the mess. Mm. I mean, whether it's Luke's account or Matthew's account, this is not pretty. Mm-hmm. In the Lucan account, Mary and Joseph are at the bottom of a power play by Imperial Rome, and there ain't no room for them, so they are literally homeless. So Jesus knows what it's like to be homeless. Mm-hmm. And in the Matthean account, Jesus, Mary and Joseph are tainted by scandal. Joseph is regarded as someone who doesn't have the guts to divorce her, so maybe he's just emotionally dependent on her. This is, of course, not knowing what's really going on. And Mary, she had the gall, to just go out and have sex and then, to throw in Joseph's face with an obvious lie. Well, it turns out she wasn't lying. And it turns out Joseph is not a wimp. He's an incredibly courageous young man. And so you are seeing humanity already being called out into their best in a moment where it's at its worst. Mm-hmm. Think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then again, all the wrong people come and worship. Jesus makes a beeline to all the wrong people. And he does it even as a baby. So, maybe one of the ways that we might think about celebrating is what does it mean to perhaps instead of trying to create the ultimate sentimental experience. And again, I'm not anti-Christmas with family. I mean, it's cool. Mm-hmm. And I really like it. And present gifting is really beautiful because it shows how we love each other. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's time that you go feed the homeless on Christmas Day. Mm. Or maybe it's time to think about, in our church, we've got clothing drives where we are partnering with various homeless agencies. What does it mean that you might go blow your $100 on 5 or 6 coats so somebody doesn't freeze to death this year? Mm-hmm. So you're actually being Jesus to people. That's incarnation. Mm-hmm. Because we are temples of the Holy Spirit. We are God's house. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to represent God to others, to bear the presence of God, to allow God to incarnate himself in us. Now, not like the incarnation, capital I, but what if we're little I incarnations? Mm-hmm. Little places where people experience grace. So we get to be grace spaces for people. That might be the way, especially if Christmas is painful, that what happens if you go lighten someone's load? In the various ways that might be possible. And you might discover what God with us means by being the way God is with someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to me, that's where it gets down and dirty.
Mm. Interesting. I think that really answered one of our final question that we mm-hmm. always ask yeah. is now what do we do with all this?
Yeah.
Let me just kind of do a little overview and kind of mm-hmm. Throw stuff back to you and see if I've got the highlights and anything else you'd add that mm-hmm. like the incarnation is this ultimate anti-power move that God kind of flips everything on its head.
Yeah.
He enters into the mess and he becomes, he does it in a way that he could have done it other ways, but he chose this mm-hmm. very extreme personal overly loving way to mm-hmm. do it because it's in his character, not because it's necessary because it's coherent with his character, mm-hmm. not more of the the idea that a holy God cannot be in the presence of sin. Mm-hmm. It's actually the exact opposite, that he chooses to be in the presence of sin when it comes mm-hmm. to a loving relationship with us.
Yeah. In other words, when God does God, you get Jesus and you get the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. that would be another way of saying it's necessary.
Hmm.
God does God, and this is what happens.
Yeah. And then understanding like what was happening, that he was fully God and mm-hmm. fully human all at the same time, which is not easy to understand or grasp or really nail down in any way, but it's the truth that we can't really grasp or wrap our head around it.
Yeah, just picture your brain exploding.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Philippians 2 because this is probably one of the first Christian hymns.
Okay.
And either Paul wrote it or he's quoting somebody. But it's talking about Jesus, and it says, who being in very being God, did not consider equality with God to be something to be exploited. Why? Because God doesn't exploit. So, you know, in other words, the first thing about God the Son is because he's God, he doesn't exploit stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, some theologians, I think in the 7th century, began to talk about how the Trinity is a dance of mutual servanthood. So God being God as God the Son, being in very nature with God the Father and God the Spirit, he wouldn't be God if he was exploiting it.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, instead, he makes himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant and being made as a human being. You know, and then even further, humbled himself to being obedient to death, even death on the cross. And this is interesting because the obedient word, which means he's the one true human who can actually obey all the way to solving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Us as humans either would come up short, we're not up for the job, or because we're sinful, we would refuse the job because it doesn't serve our needs, mm-hmm. doesn't serve our interest to go get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet God being God, and so the God who is exalted is the God who does not take his own being and use it for exploitation. So it is the one on the cross that we exalt and say Jesus is Lord, mm-hmm. not the one on some abstract throne, mm-hmm. because the throne is actually made of wood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the God in the manger who we worship.
Do you think that because we live in a culture that's 2,000 years on from this story,
mm-hmm.
that we miss the shockingness of it sometimes? And maybe how do we go about really realizing how mm-hmm. incredible it actually was when we're so familiar with the story?
Oh, yeah. You know, the old saying, familiarity breeds contempt, mm-hmm. or in this case, sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very hard for us to get our brains around Christmas. I mean, what I'm saying, I firmly believe, but emotionally, I have to sit and think about it hard to even get within a mile or two of just how utterly weird this is.
Mm.
And I mean weird in the best way possible. It's not weird, it's God.
Mm-hmm.
But because we're so messed up, it looks weird.
Mm.
And so, yeah, we have, you know, just 2,000 years of barnacles, cultural barnacles on the boat, so you can't see the hull.
Yeah.
And it takes great discipline to strip the barnacles off so you can start seeing the hull of the boat again.
Mm-hmm.
There was a church in Portland where what they did is they all as a congregation, not everybody, but they offered the possibility that instead of giving gifts to each other, they would give gifts to the homeless. And so that's the way they celebrated gift giving, is they didn't give in their homes.
Mm.
And again, that in some ways makes more sense because it's God's self-giving. Again, I'm not against giving gifts at Christmas per se, but there's something to be said to think about it, because when you think of the massive stress bomb a modern Christmas season is, I mean, heck, we've been buying stuff since Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we buy things we can't afford for people we don't particularly like. we sort of play the whole can you up this game, and we're all freaked out that our gift won't be as good as whatever they give us, so that it isn't a socially awkward situation where we hurt somebody's feelings and they won't talk to us for 6 months. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's just, oh boy, did I give the right gift? Oh, was that over the top or was that enough? What will my kids think? Am I a good parent? Am I a good daughter? You know, oh, the office party. Ugh. You know, and on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, there's a reason why there's a rise in depression during the Christmas season, because it's all about competition and achievement and who wins and who loses, rather than a God who lavishes his extravagant, unbelievable love on us by becoming one of us.
Which almost, it sounds the opposite of the point, obviously, because you mentioned early on about like this role reversal, this anti-power move of flipping things upside down.
Yeah.
And this, what you just described of the stressful Christmas season is of the other direction, right? Of the working up, of trying to compete, of trying to match, of trying to, meet expectations in a certain way about going up rather than going down.
Yeah. Now, what I don't want to be is one of those grumpy Christians who says, I'm not going to give gifts. Oh, we're not going to engage in the materialistic culture. We're going to be separate and better because we're more righteous than all of them. Yeah. And all those churches who've compromised and on and on and on because we're the pure people.
Yeah.
Well, just remember, the pure people killed Jesus. Let's just get that down.
Yeah.
There is something to be said for Christmas cheer. But I believe that where that comes from is Jesus, not putting on a smile and forcing it even though you're hurting on the inside. Mm. In other words, what does it mean to know how much God is with you and for you to the point that he'd literally go to hell and back for you, be born in a trough full of snot and whatever else, you know, in one of the poorest periods of history? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really pretty great grounds for Christmas cheer. Mm-hmm. Being a nerd, I love classical music, and I have an album called A Praetorius Christmas, written by a guy named Michael Praetorius in the 17th century, early 1600s. And it's all this Renaissance music, so it sounds kind of nerdy. But when you look at it in its context, and I love the way they recorded it, kind of the way it actually would have been done in a Lutheran church on Christmas Eve in Germany. It's a raucousy affair. I mean, they are partying. I mean, they're singing loud, you know, and it's a bit rough. Mm. And you can just tell everybody's just getting into it, you know, and it's not this nice, clean, pretty performance. Mm-hmm. And it just, I always play it every year because it's just so earthy. You know, you can imagine all the farmers and the tradespeople getting together, also, you know, with the landed nobility and the local prince of the land, all the poor and the wealthy packed into this church. Mm-hmm. And the choir's been rehearsing along with the instrumentalists and the organist forever. And off it goes. And it starts out with a chant. And then it kicks into a big old kind of rough Christmas carol using a very secular tune that probably originally had bawdy lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so even there, you know, they're redeeming earthy things. Mm. And that was the common thing in the Lutheran churches, is to take secular bar music and turn it into worship songs.
Huh. Okay.
You know, so there we go. Contemporary music at its finest in the 17th century.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. Is there anything else that you would hit on the incarnation or Christmas before we wrap things up? I think we got it as covered as we can for an hour.
Yeah, just remember, behold what love the Father has for us, that we should become the children of God. And this is love, not that we love God, but that God loved us. Mm. And so my hope for you this Christmas season is that you would just be blown away by the amazing love of God, that he would become a baby in the manger.
That's good. Good place to end, I think.
You bet.
Thank you for joining us today. And as always, if you have any questions on a previous topic or suggestions for a future one, we would love to hear from you. You can click the link in the description to submit those. That's linktree.com/wordwithweb. We'll talk to you next time.
You bet. Have a blessed Advent and a Merry Christmas.